The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Why is it important to make art out of everyday life?
For me, it's a path to wholeness. So when things get crazy in my life, I photograph and I write. And also, for me, art has always been a really good way to connect with other people and also to learn more about the world and also about myself.
I think that everyday things are so important. Like the little things that you see every day, if you can get those down, that really, really makes a difference, I think, in your writing. If you can get those words down, that's what I say.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with San Francisco Bay Area photographer Sue Reynolds and Salish poet Victor Charlot about their book titled Still Here, Not Living in Teepees. Sue, in the introduction to this book, you mentioned discovering a parallel between traumas specific to American Indian people and your personal search for healing and forgiveness. And you wrote, quote, "Those days early on the powwow trail moved me, helping me redeem my own sense of identity." What took you to the powwow trail, and how did those experiences impact your sense of identity?
In 2005, I went up to Rocky Mountain School of Photography with an intention to change my life. I wanted to do different kind of work. I had been doing marketing and business career for 25 years. I was pretty burned out on that. And I'd also spent 10 years of that time caring for my mom. And she had Alzheimer's and other diseases. And I was really burned out on everything. And so I went up there to Missoula and heard about a powwow up at R. Lee, and I'd never been to a powwow. My only contact with Native American people had really been through museums and books, not any firsthand kind of contact. And so I drove up to R. Lee, and I walked across the meadow there and heard the drums in the arbor, and I really felt at home. I felt like those drums had called me to a really good place. And a couple of weeks later, I went up to Elma, to the Kootenai Powwow, and I started meeting Native American people and talking and doing a few portraits. But a lot of it was just getting to know them and finding out about them and their lives and why they were dancing and why they were celebrating. And I started asking them, where are some other good powwows around Montana? Because I was going to be up there for another 4 or 5 weeks. So I heard about one over at the Blackfeet Reservation, the Heart Butte Celebration. And I went over there and spent 3 days. And I think it was at that point that I realized I'd found a new path for myself. About 4 months after I got home from the summer intensive program, my mom died. And in 2006, later that year, a couple of other close relatives died. And I kind of felt like I'd lost my identity because at the same time, shortly after my mom died, I decided I just couldn't go back to that old career. I was really, really tired of the business world and kind of the fast pace and intensity. I'd sort of done that. So I really, through the powwows and through spending time with Native American people, I began to see that there were some values that I wanted to put back at the center of my own life. And these values were things like family first. I felt like I'd lost so much of my own family. I'm an only child. I have no children. And when my mom died, and these other relatives died, I kind of felt like I was out there by myself. And other values like doing good things for community, the fact that many Native Americans find that spirit lives everywhere, that that's very important. Those were all things that I wanted to put back at the center of my own life at that point. And so really, I think that's continuing to go to celebrations as I came home back here to the Bay Area. I just was finding that it was making me feel really good. It was making me feel whole. And as I went through my grief journey, Native American people seem to be, in many cases, more patient with the grieving process and how long it was taking and sort of the depth of it than some people of my own culture. So I think all of those things just led me on this path and gave me a new life.
Vic, how did your collaboration with Sue begin? Where did you meet her?
We met up at the Nine Pipe. And at first, we were just friends. You know, we weren't talking about any kinds of collaboration or anything like that. And she liked what I was doing, and I liked what she was doing. And that's kind of how it started.
Do you remember the conversation when it was first mentioned that you would do a collaboration between your poetry and her photography?
Well, when she first started talking about it was about last year. And I was saying, well, yeah, sure. That sounds like a good idea. And at that point, that's just kind of where it was at with me. It was like, that's a good idea. And then Sue just took it and just ran with it.
Why is the book titled Still Here? I know there's an image in the book that says Still Here, but there must be a deeper story there.
Well, there is. I give photo talks to audiences mostly around the San Francisco Bay Area. And before I give each photo talk, I like to talk to Native American friends and people I'm meeting at gatherings, Native people. And I ask them, what is the single most important thing you would like a non-Native audience to know about you as an individual Native American person, or you as a member of a specific tribe, or you in general as a Native American person? And the most common, frequent answer that I get is, tell them we are still here. And the second most common answer is the rest of the title of the book, Not Living in Teepees. They say, tell them we don't still live in teepees. So there's actually so much, I guess, ignorance and misunderstanding by most of America about Native Americans and who they are, that I wanted to take those two most frequently misunderstood pieces and make them the title. So that title was really given to me by Native American people.
Mm. I want to come back to something you just said in a few minutes. But first, according to your publicity statement, Still Here is the first photo book collaboration between a white urban observer, which would be you, Sue, and a reservation Indian. As the reservation Indian, Vic, what does it mean to you to have these images in your poetry out in the world in this collaboration?
Well, again, I never thought about doing this. And when I saw the photographs, I thought, wow, that's really, really something. Something should be done with that. And when the poetry came up, I thought, yeah, that'd be really, really great if we could take those pictures and take a poem and put them together and see what that looked like. And Sue has done that, and I think she's done a great job.
Let's have you read one of those poems. It's called Elders Week, and it's on a page in the book that the picture opposite is of a fancy dancer.
Elders Week. We are Indian. We make our stand. But this year, we ask elders, moon, stars, old times, to remind us how we once were. Drum talks to clay cliffs that watched our blood ride before time. How was it? Songs ring memories like dark water.
You mentioned in this poem, Elders Week, that the younger people are asking the elders to tell their stories. How is that going now with your people? What are the elders telling the younger people?
Well, it seems like they're telling them a lot more in depth, more things. Before, it was pretty much just surface things. But now it seems like they're getting to more in depth. Like, for instance, they're talking about climate change right now, things like that, which are really important to us. And those are things that I think that we have to talk about. Before, we were talking about the drum, we were talking about, you know, the things that are right there. But I think they're getting a little bit deeper now, the things that we're talking about.
The reasons that those elders didn't talk for a long time was because they were told not to. when they were in the schools that were run by the white missionaries or the government.
That was one of the things that really hurt a lot of us. Because again, you know, we knew the native language and we didn't know English. And so for us to just, you know, say anything would probably be wrong. And so we just kind of kept a low profile and just let other people say maybe what they thought we were like.
So that poem is paired, as I said, with an image of a fancy dancer. What was happening when you took that photograph and where were you?
Well, that was actually at the Arlie celebration. And I photographed that at night, and it was probably during, this was back in 2006, so I'm trying to reach back here, but it was probably during a fancy dance contest dancing, because that dancer was really, really good and caught my eye. And so I wanted to show the incredible energy and also that, I guess, a feeling for me of spirit that's often present, usually present at powwows. And so I used a slow shutter speed to capture the motion and really create a feeling of spirit and energy.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with San Francisco Bay Area photographer Sue Reynolds and Salish poet Victor Charlot about their book titled Still Here, Not Living in Teepees. We'll be back after a short break to talk about the devastating effects of racism on young American Indians and hear Victor Charlot read more poems. Don't go away. You wrote that there were times when you encountered, quote, native anger and non-native racism. Can you be a little more specific? Where were you and who said what?
Well, native anger doesn't come up that often, but when it does happen, it's more often to happen here in the San Francisco Bay Area than across the Northern Plains and Rockies. And when a Native American expresses anger, and often I'm asking permission to take a photograph, they see that I've got a large camera slung around my neck. And so when they express anger, I'll listen for a while. And if that person continues to be really angry, I walk away because there's not going to be a dialogue with that person. I certainly respect people's right to be angry. And at the same time, what I'm doing really depends on our ability, our shared ability to have a conversation.
Is this anger, do you think, that comes up because of what happened between the cultures in the past? Or is this, don't take my photograph because I don't want you stealing my culture now?
I think it's a little of both. And I think there's also a third piece that I wasn't even really aware of until pretty recently. I was talking with a part Cherokee, part white acquaintance who dances here in the Bay Area at powwows about why there seems to be more anger here among Native American people. And he said that he thinks it's partly because the out-of-state Indians, the people who left their tribes in rural reservations and they came here to the big city for jobs and education, that their anger maybe comes from being cut off from their families, you know, that they're not in their community back home. And I'd heard a similar kind of thing, not so much anger, but more just feeling really, really cut off and lonely from a Mandan, a gentleman from North Dakota who was living here in the Bay Area. And he just said it's really, really hard to live so far from his relatives. And the more I thought about it, I think the importance of family, particularly to Native American people, is huge. And I think perhaps living far away from their family, which would probably mean for most Native people, that's extended family and community where they've spent all their lives, that would be incredibly painful. Mm-hmm. I think about the fact I've lived here in the Bay Area pretty much my entire life, and my family's here. It would be painful if I was living for years away from my family.
And what about the non-Native racism?
Well, you know, that's something that I hear about probably a little more than I experience it firsthand. I hear about it from Native friends and Crow friends and Assiniboine friends who have shared stories of how hard it was for them to grow up on the Fort Peck and the Crow reservations. And when I asked them, well, how is it now for you guys? And they said, well, not that much has changed. I also spent some time with Lakota Episcopalians at a gathering called Niobrara Convocation, which happens on reservations around South Dakota. And so I've gotten to know some of the Episcopal clergy, both Native American and non-Native Episcopal clergy. And some ministers that serve Crow Creek and Lower Brule, and also one that serves the Lakota people on Pine Ridge Reservation, have told me some really horrifying stories. And I think what sticks in my mind the most is how racism affects people. So in South Dakota, I hear from clergy friends that there's a trend among the youth on reservations there to plan and carry out group suicide. And, you know, that is such a horrifying impact in terms of loss of life. And then there's loss of health, alcoholism, and physical other kinds of abuse. And I've got to believe that a part of that is a response to Native people being told by their white neighbors, you're no good. And there is something else that happened when I was up at Rocky Mountain School of Photography there, and it's kind of led me to believe that racism is something that we're taught, but that it can be unlearned. When I was presenting a portfolio of my first Native American portraits at the school in 2005, I was talking about those traditional Native values that I mentioned earlier that I was witnessing and really wanting to put back to the center of my own life. And so after I talked about all of that, and after we were all done presenting our portfolios, there were two young women, classmates, that came up to me, and they said, Sue, thank you for showing us that there's something to understand and respect about Native American people. And when I heard that, I was shocked. I thought, how can 20-somethings need someone else, need an outsider like me to show them that there's something to know and respect about their Native American neighbors who live just up the road? And so really, that conversation back in 2005 was the beginning of what I've been doing for the last 8 years.
Well, Vic, let's hear another poem. I'd like you to read Agnes again. And I think this is a poem you wrote about one of your teachers.
Yes. She was one of my, she was my mentor. And she taught me a lot of stuff. And it's called Agnes Again. She teaches so I won't forget. She sings sore-footed horse's song, who says, I'll be all right and we'll travel again. She digs bitterroot so that children and grandchildren will know how to use the root for better times. The song remains in my mind. I would travel with sore-footed horse as he sings of better times. We'd run wild with wind, catch stars with buffalo, crowd clouds.
And was Agnes the woman who taught you Puché?
She was.
The concept of Puché.
Yeah, she was the one who, that was one of her favorite sayings, Puché. And there's a little hand movement that you got to do with it. And she would do that for me, and she just made me laugh. That just made me laugh. I just thought that was just so funny. And she would just say that all the time. And so finally, when it came to a title for a book, what could it be but Pooche?
And tell everybody what that means.
That means good enough. And when she would used to say that, good enough. And, you know, it's okay. If it's not the best, it's good enough. And that's what she liked.
Sometimes we have to get to that point in our lives.
Yeah.
Do you mind reading To Eagle River?
Okay. Let's see. To Eagle River. Eagles. I keep thinking eagles. I look out this window and see nest, and sometimes I see dark forms that say eagles. We talk. Living river. Some say they are and some say they aren't. I believe that I want a feather, not because eagle is more eagle, because of feather. I have watched and wondered. This makes me want some part of what is across the other side, living river.
What is the significance of the eagle feather?
Well, it's sacred. It's a sacred feather for us, and we treat it with great reverence. And so with each eagle feather, It has significance. And so when I have a feather, you know, it's special. As a matter of fact, I found a feather. One of the feathers I use in my car, I found it in my yard. And there are eagles. Well, see, that's where Two Eagle first came from, is that there's an eagle tree across from where the old school used to be. And that's where the name came from, Two Eagle River School. As a matter of fact, that is my name. I gave that name to the school. And that's what just makes eagles special. And again, when we, with our war bonnets and all our regalia, we use eagle feathers because they're the sacred feather that we always use.
And how do you get those eagle feathers these days?
It's not easy. You have to go through the federal government, and they will send you an eagle. In the early days, it happened. It happened quite a bit. I know of people who would get eagle parts or get the whole eagle, and they would take it. But lately, I haven't been seeing that for some reason, that maybe that the eagles just aren't available as they were, or what the problem was, but it seems like we're not getting those eagles like we used to.
Well, I want to go back to the idea that American Indians are still here and that they don't live in teepees. Sue, I'm wondering, as gorgeous as these photos are, do these photos, which are mostly taken at celebrations, they aren't photos of everyday life, does that somehow perpetuate the romantic notions of American Indian culture as part of the mythic West?
It's a good question. I'm very much intending that they don't do that, and part of that is because before I make a portrait, I spend some time getting to know the person. So I'm not just running out there, running up to someone saying, can I take your picture and taking a shot? See, typically we'll share a meal together or at least sit and talk a while. I'm really interested in getting to know Native American people who, at least here in California, are pretty invisible. And so when we sit down and talk, we're creating a feeling of trust. And I think by the time I make the photograph, that person's stories and who they really are seem to live within the image. And people tell me when they see the portraits in particular, that they feel a connection, and sometimes they're not real specific about that, but they say they feel a strong emotional connection with that person. And I'm thinking now, and there's one portrait of Hildegard Smith, who was at the Heart Butte celebration on the Blackfeet Reservation. I think that was in 2007, maybe. She had just been honored. She was in her early 90s when I made that portrait. And I spent a little time talking with her and with her cousin who came down from Canada for the celebration. And then I met her son, and we spent some time chatting. And so by the time I made a portrait of Hildegard, I wasn't exactly a stranger to her. She wasn't exactly a stranger to me. And people tell me when they see that picture, they just go, wow, because there's something there that's touching the real person.
Her face, but it's also her eyes. Her eyes
exactly.
are just really, I don't know, they're bright with love, I guess, and they're very dark eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, you know, I think what I'm trying to do when I make the photographs is to create relationships one at a time and to move past those stereotypes. So even though many of my pictures, the majority in that book, in the New Still Here book, are taken at Native celebrations, they are moving past stereotypes to what we all share as human beings. And you mentioned you saw that feeling of love in Hildegard's eyes, and really that's what I'm capturing, is who are we really as human beings? We share that love.
Mm-hmm. And Sue, what's your next project?
Oh, boy. I'm looking at maybe doing something right here at home. I had an interesting conversation a few years ago with a young boy, a Crow friend, who told me about his experience being teased by white classmates. And he said, get to know the Native Americans who live right where you live. And so, again, as I mentioned, it's important to get to know the Native American neighbors right down the road. I'm starting to photograph Ohlone people, who are the first Native American people here in the East Bay of the San Francisco Bay Area. So I'm looking at where that is all going to go.
And Vic, you're working on a new collection of poetry?
Yes, I am. And hopefully, well, again, I don't know when it'll be out, but it's going to be out soon.
It's book publishing. We never know when these things are going to happen.
Exactly.
Well, Vic, let's end with hearing you read Frog Creek Circle.
Okay.
Which you say is dedicated for my family, especially Jan.
Who used to be my wife and who is still good friends of mine. Frog Creek Circle for my family, especially Jan. Mountain so close we are relative, creek so cold it brings winter rain. We return to warm August home, Frog Creek, where I've lived so long that smells are stored, opened only here. This land never changes, always whole, always the way we want it to be. We always come back to check our senses or to remember dreams. We are remembered today in circles of family, of red pine, of old-time chiefs, of forgotten horses that thunder dark stars. These are songs that we come to this day, soft as Indian mint, strange as this sky.
Information about where to purchase Still Here, Not Living in Teepees, is available at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. Also there, a link to audio, in case you'd like to listen to this program again or send it to a friend. And more about Sue Reynolds and Victor Charlo, plus links to our podcast and Facebook page. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.